So how do you manage a software product when it's open source, community driven, and powers 35% of the web? Like, how do you make decisions? And that's a big topic in general, right? Like, how do you, there's been a lot of talk about governance in WordPress. Like, how do you decide how things get done? We were talking about this, and you came across someone whose work that you found really interesting, and I thought, oh, it might be interesting to discuss this from a context that's not just immersed in our own world. Luke, what'd you come up with?
Ryan Singer is the head of product strategy at Basecamp. He's been at Basecamp really from the beginning, right, Ryan? Around 17 years. Ryan is a designer. He is a programmer, product strategist, an all-around deep thinker. I've been consuming some of his podcasts, which I've had several mind-blown moments. And importantly, he's recently published a book called Shape Up about how to define and build software, and it's available for free on the Basecamp website. I believe it's basecamp.com/shapeup. The reason why this book is important is because, in my opinion, this is the single best approach to building software that I've ever come across. The best thing since we learned the word agile. And it's good because I'm about to just lather a little praise on you, Ryan. It's good because I feel like it speaks to me on a level where I've known this all along. And at the same time, it sort of puts into words the approach that I want to take towards software going forward. So yeah, this has been simultaneously the most impactful and the least impactful book on my career. Does that make sense?
And the least.
Right,
So I
because
had a
I feel
problem
like this
with
is always what's worked for me, right?
the book. But now you have a framing for it. Welcome, Ryan. It's great to have you. I
Yeah,
had a
thanks for
problem with
having
the
me.
book. I started reading the book, and with each chapter, I've only made it to chapter 5 so far. And with each chapter, I ended like, okay, I got to go work on this. I had like, it kept giving me things that I felt very inspired with each one. So good problem to have. But it's like, oh, I could apply this to a book that I'm working on, right? Where I'm going to do the shaping first before I kind of get to the other things. It gave me, like Luke described, a framing for something that I already sort of believed to be true, but a different way of looking at it that gave a sharpness and a focus that, oh, I could do it this way. This helps me understand why the outlining process works for me, how that sort of happens on my own, and to give it this lens of shaping, to think of it that way. Because ultimately, so much about this is when you're in a leadership role and people are counting on you to do things, it's really helpful to have language to describe processes and like why you're doing something a certain way. And I felt that. It's like, oh, I could explain this process as a shaping process and why it happens this way. So I have not finished it yet. Because each time I go into it, it's like there's something I can take and apply outside of it.
So, although I would like to keep Shape Up all to myself and not let anybody know about anything in it because I'd really like for it to be my secret superpower, perhaps, Ryan, you could just briefly touch on some of the main focuses of the book for us.
So I think a good way to start is to look at the things that kind of aren't working that might make us want to look to improve the way that we work, because methodologies or whatever, like who cares, until you reflect on what's going on in your own day, and you see like, okay, this maybe there's something that I need to change. One of the things that we see quite a lot of is people feeling like there was a time in the past when we used to ship a lot, And then what happened to
Yeah,
that?
the way that frames for me is, what can't we go back to the startup culture? There's a startup, and when you get to a certain size, you lose that energy.
Exactly. So that's one thing that brings people in is like, look, there's got to be some way that we can start to ship again and not just be in kind of this never-ending project mode that we've sort of found ourselves in, and we don't know how we got here. We don't really see the way out, and ShapeUp is it's packaging up the things that we figured out how to do at Basecamp as we grew, so that, you know, this was driven by Jason and David's very productive sense of impatience. You know, like they, as the two founders who were there from the beginning, they had this, they were always pushing in when it was just four or five of us, you know, to make a decision, make something real, put it out there, and then move on and do something else. There was this like go, go, go feeling. And then as we grew, fortunately, they weren't willing to just kind of accept that there was some new reality where like things didn't get done anymore, you know? And so we were kind of always in this, you know, there's this, my friend Bob Mesta he used this phrase recently. He said, there's a difference between working on the work and working in the work.
Yeah.
And, or like on the business and in the business. And so there's always been this part of us that as a team was reflecting not on just like the feature we're trying to build, but also kind of like, what was the process that we used to get this feature done? And was it the right number of weeks? And you know what I mean? Did we organize ourselves in the right way? And we were always kind of working on this meta level to try and like solve this problem. And so that's something that we actually did succeed in solving. And we've kept up a shipping cadence through all these years, despite growing to a very different size than we were when we were that tiny startup. So that's one thing. The other big thing that drives people to something like ShapeUp is you get people in a sort of a product leadership position, which is a little bit slippery to define. Sometimes it's a founder, sometimes it's a product manager, you know what I mean? Like sometimes it's like a senior designer, but there's somebody who feels like it's their responsibility to be looking ahead and figuring out like where should we go next and what's important. And that person is finding that so much of their time is getting eaten up by like stupid micromanagement. You know, like you want to be thinking about like the next big feature and you can somehow never get there because you're just busy in like meetings all week or answering questions or kind of dealing with like little minutia of scheduling. And then what you end up doing is you end up like spending time on a Saturday to try and think about like your vision for where you want the next big iteration to go. And you think like, why am I doing this on a Saturday? You know? And so a huge part of ShapeUp is about, it's not just about shipping, which you could maybe imagine is about like, you know, you could just crank everything up to 11 and then just burn everybody out and ship faster. Right. And that's not what it's about. It's actually, how do we, carve out time by, increasing there's a sort of construction team, you know, that's like building the thing, right? How do we give them more autonomy? How do we give them the structure and the boundaries and the empowerment that they need to do more decision-making on their own and more self-organization? And if we can successfully do that, then we who are on the more leadership side can actually use the time when they're building to think.
The way that I thought of that was when I was reading it, it was basically how can we minimize the BS that we have to deal with in particular existing frameworks or, you know, best practices, which in my experience are rarely even good practices, let alone best ones.
Well, what I've come to see is that a lot of what are now common practices like sprint planning and backlog management and stuff like that, actually, these are all designed around a situation where work comes to you from the outside. Like work is somehow queuing up and piling up because all kinds of people are asking you for things, whether it's customers or clients or stakeholders or your boss, or, you know, this work is like piling and then you are trying to somehow survive. Like, how do I get through this pile week after week after week after week? And ShapeUp isn't about how do I deal with a pile of stuff. ShapeUp is about how do I intentionally steer the product into the market position I want it to be in. How do we build and work on stuff that we think is meaningful and valuable? And how do we sort of drive that from like our definition of what's important? And then of course, you know, customer feedback, requests, issues, all that stuff is like is an input source to our strategic thinking. So we can be listening to all the things that are coming in from customers and everything to think about what we might do, but that's just an input.
Yeah.
You know, and then we form a strategic idea of what is meaningful and valuable, both from a sort of market standpoint and also from a supply side of like, what do we want to be and what do we want to offer and who are we and like what gets us excited, you know? And then we can actually shape a project that fulfills that, what like where we want to go and what we want to be doing.
You know, when you mention these giant backlogs and work coming in, one of the first things that jumps to mind for me is Track. Track is the issue tracker that's used by WordPress Core. And how many times, Jonathan, have you seen come up, oh, I want to address this issue that is 7 years old that hasn't yet been looked at. And it seems like it's just this constant, unfinishable wealth of jobs to do.
There's no end to it. And as the project increases in size and scale, there's only more and more of that. And occasionally there'll be these efforts, I think really well-intended, of like, okay, we need to get through all that. And well, it's like when I clear my inbox periodically, it usually only spawns that much more sort of coming in. So I think it's without intending to, you can end up focusing on the wrong problem by just saying, how do we just manage that? How do we get through this? Like you're kind of stuck there without being able to take a step back.
At a certain scale, bugs are just the edges of what works.
Yeah.
And the idea, yeah, there's always an edge to the world, you know, and it's more about what happens inside the boundaries of the world that works and less about what happens on the edges, because there's always going to be edges.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good point. And that's been a bit more of my approach to time management these days, which is like, okay, there's an infinite number of inputs and things to do, so I can't get them all done. So you might as well find something that sort of keeps you sane and just recognize that those are just indicators that there's a lot going on.
On the other hand, WordPress is by nature, you know, it's an open source project. It's community driven. And so there needs to be an avenue for people involved in WordPress, people interested in WordPress, technical and non-technical alike, to be able to get involved with that strategic phase. And that's sort of one of the key considerations, one of the key difficulties.
So I'd love to just establish a baseline, Ryan. I'd love to just get your current sense of perspective on the WordPress project, like as little or as much as you know. I'm just kind of curious, like what's your sense and perspective of the project as a whole? What experience, if any, have you had sort of with it?
I have, I've built on WordPress in the past, not recently. I see WordPress as the thing that does everything. If you don't want to build something from scratch, and you are a fairly technical person. So there's a level of technical skill, and this is just totally my outside view, but this is what I'm looking for. There's a level of technical skill where like you're going to go spin up a raw, you know, Rails app or whatever and build what you want. Right. And then there's a level of modularity above that where you say, look, I'm not reinventing any wheels here. And it's not worth it for me to custom write everything that I'm doing. But at the same time, what I'm doing is more demanding than a Squarespace site. What I'm doing is more demanding than like a Wix site. So on the Squarespace and Wix end, you have something that is a little bit more narrow in terms of what you can do, but it's a bit more accessible in terms of the amount of integrating and figuring out that you have to do to make something happen. And WordPress seems to kind of occupy a very wide space in between these two, where it is in a way kind of gnarly in the sense that there's like a lot of what's possible and you actually need to know a lot and learn a lot to kind of deal with it. But the reason that you're willing to sort of do that is because it has a far greater range of capability than something like a Squarespace. And at the same time, you are in a more modular environment where you're getting working chunks of functionality at a higher level than if you were to try and code something from scratch.
Yeah, I'd say you nailed it. Out of interest, if you had to just quickly guess, take the top million sites in the world, take all of the traffic that those websites will receive today, what percentage of that traffic do you think is powered by WordPress?
You know, I believe I may have seen this number before, and I remember being shocked by it. So I'm gonna throw out a really high number and say like 70 or something, because I remember it being very big.
I think Matt Mullenweg would be happy if that were the number, but but it's half of that, which is still to me massive.
Okay, that's still like totally massive. Like the fact that it's even, yeah. Okay, so the half of it, so like
35% currently.
But the web is big. That is a lot of sites. That is unbelievable.
And it could even, of course, be bigger than that. But like we have limited ways of sort of looking at it.
Yeah.
Just based on what we can tell.
Yeah, but that's incredible. Mm. I mean, that's massive. By the way, just because I'm curious, like, is there any, how far, do you have any sense of like what the number two is? Like, I'm guessing that if you look at the distribution of like other things, that like it's not like WordPress is 35 and then something else is 65. You know what I mean? It's probably like, no. It's probably all smaller numbers than that. Like I imagine WordPress is one of the bigger shares.
I should know this, but I think the next biggest is like a 5%.
Okay. That explains my mental image of like a 70%, because I had the sense that this was like.
You know what? It is in fact 70% of all sites that use CMSs. If there's a CMS, like it's more than 70% use WordPress, but that greater number, it's like, this includes, and this is why it's inaccurate, because sites that use WordPress headless wouldn't show in the stats.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But of those where we know it's a CMS, it is more than 70%. And the next closest is, I think it's probably more than 5% in that case, but it is way smaller.
Gotcha. Sorry for the digression. Where were we?
So we have these big numbers and this sort of sense of WordPress. And I think your perspective is quite spot on in terms of like the nature of it. I'm curious, Ryan, if you have any thought or perspective on what does that matter at all? Like within the context of the, because this show, we talk about WordPress, but for us, the open web, this idea of an open web is also important. And for me personally, I've had this draw towards, I think there's a world where like SaaS proprietary platforms and open source could play really well together. I'm curious for your perspective. Like when you think about the size of WordPress we'll get next to like how the project works. Do you have any thoughts or not on like, does it matter? Is there any importance within the grander scheme of a project like this? Like why should it matter?
Does it matter to what? Does it matter
to the web as a whole?
Oh,
right?
I don't know about that. I mean, it seems very natural that there would be winner take all effects.
Yeah.
As far as I can see, WordPress doesn't exert a kind of downward pressure that forces people to stay in it. Mm. So I could, you know, if there's a winner take all effect, but then you have a kind of anti-competitive thing that comes out the other end of that, then, you know, then you could get into trouble. So for example, like there's been a lot of criticism of Apple lately because of the fact that they completely own the App Store. And then at the same time, they're starting to squeeze people for a percentage of their revenue, regardless of sort of what their model is. That kind of thing starts to feel like it might be bad. But it seems to me that what we're seeing with the scale of WordPress is more just a bottom up natural winner take all phenomenon. And it could easily happen that something else comes in that integrates differently or scratches an itch differently according to the changing needs of people. And that thing could easily take over. And that WordPress doesn't kind of create an obstacle to that, you know? From that standpoint, it doesn't seem unhealthy to me.
That's a good articulation. My position is that WordPress by its nature, because it doesn't force, like even a company like Automattic where I'm employed, like we create like SaaS-like experiences in WordPress, but you're not forced to use those, mm-hmm. right? Like you could use someone else's app store, mm-hmm. if you will. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, like my position is that WordPress by its nature, its existence and success is good for the web versus a dominant platform that didn't allow it. But and it's an interesting point, like WordPress by its nature is also set up to allow its eventual takeover mm-hmm. by something that just like because there's no stopping of it, right? A really good integration could come in and just sort of sweep yep. over for better or for worse. Yep. Okay.
So it's less about, it's a really sort of nuanced point where we typically talk about open versus closed ecosystems or proprietary versus open source software. More to what you're getting at is it takeoverable? Does it sort of establish market dominance and then prevent anybody else from establishing market dominance?
Yeah. Does it interfere with the selection mechanism, or is it just right. Is it just a winner within the rules of the existing selection mechanism?
Yeah, I like that. And I mean, I think this is part of the reason why I'm such a huge advocate for open source and open platforms, because mm-hmm. almost by default, it has that escape hatch.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So let's talk about the project itself. I think I just wanted to set that context a little bit. So there's the way that things get done. What are we up to now, Luke? How many releases is it a year? 3 or 4?
Something like that.
And I think for Ryan's benefit and for those who don't follow, let's just touch on like how that currently happens. So
let's riff against each other here, Jonathan. Interrupt me and tell me where I've missed steps. Maybe we start with a release lead being chosen.
Yep.
And that's done in a meeting, which occurs on Slack in text. During that meeting, we ask for nominations and people nominate themselves or others. And, you know, in chat, we select a release lead.
Yes.
The release lead would then go on to define what the priorities for the release should be. Oftentimes that comes directly from Matt Mullenweg, who is our BDFL, a familiar term maybe, you know, DHH has often been described as a BDFL. When I think of benevolent dictator for life, I think of Matt and David. Mm-hmm. And so Matt might say, hey, these are going to be the focuses for this release, or it might be up to the release lead. Is that fair, Jonathan?
I think it's fair. I think what I would just add there and imagine where we're going, like there is a lot, I see there being a lot of room for autonomy in the release lead. Like I, my own interpretation of Matt's more direct involvement has been more in service of not that there's been a lack of direction towards the vision, but like he made the push for, we're going to modernize the editor. So Gutenberg is going to be a thing. And then there've been people who've been carrying that out.
So basically the release lead finds a bunch of tickets on track and groups them together and puts them in a spreadsheet, communicates out that these are the ones that we should focus on for this release. The release lead will communicate deadlines for the release or target dates. And then fingers crossed, somebody will come along and actually do those track tickets, actually do that work. If it doesn't get done, it gets dropped from the release. If it doesn't look like it's going to get done in time, it gets dropped from the release so that we're pretty good about meeting our target dates because we just happily drop pieces of work.
Yep. So you can end up having releases that look pretty like, okay, not a whole lot there. But we've decided that it's more important to keep to that cadence and continuing to do something even if there's not a whole lot.
The first thing that jumps out very strongly is that this seems to be all around the subject of betting more than the subject of shaping. So the notion of shaping is that we need to know what it is that we're actually going to undertake before we allocate resources to it. And obviously we can't know what it is before we build it because there's a level of detail that has to sort of unfold from actually getting your hands in under the hood and getting into the work, right? So you can't like predict what the work really is before you do it, you know? So there's always this sort of guessing of like, what are we going to do? And what do we think it is versus what is it really going to be like? And then there's estimation. There's this whole tension around this subject, right? And what we do with shaping is we try to describe what the work is at the right level of abstraction. And then we're also trying to look at the pieces of the work and how they relate to each other and to the existing system to figure out like what might blow up on us or what might turn out to be harder than we thought or that kind of a thing. Because we don't want to sort of shape something and then make the investment, go bet on it, and then have it turn out to be 10 times harder than we thought, or, you know what I mean, different than what we thought it was. So this, all this shaping is about actually forming a potential bet. The thing is that, like, none of those dynamics really map very clearly to the situation that you described, because betting is about using scarce resources that you own.
Yeah,
exactly. So the fact that you don't own the resources completely changes the dynamics of the whole game.
It's true that we don't own the resources. I think it'd be unfair to discount the amount of influence that the project does exercise. Like, people, it's a big deal to get something in the WordPress release. So there tend to be bodies willing to put work and time in, because there's aligned incentives. There's companies who will dedicate resources. It's true, though, at the end of the day, it is volunteered, and people will change their minds, or they won't finish something. So that's a fairly significant aspect. You don't control it.
Yeah. And so I think it's a fascinating subject, and I think it's a subject way bigger than what I could just like, I'm having a lot of ideas right now, but they're all new ideas, because I don't think the resource allocation process that we call betting in ShapeUp directly maps here. I think all of the concepts do map when you take them individually. If you take ShapeUp as a bundle of all these different threads, and you pull these different threads apart, you could look at an individual contributor, right, who says, like, I want to contribute this improvement to the project. If that person wants to be a little bit more intentional about what they're biting off before they bite it off, or if they need to personally bet their time. You know, like, I have a side project I'm working on right now, and it turns out that I have to, like, rip out a whole bunch of old Stripe integrations that I built, because Stripe just changed so much over the last 10 years that the workarounds I was using are slowly becoming unsupported. And what I've realized is that, like, this amount of work that I had, this is me as an individual contributor, not getting paid. Nobody is, like, allocating my time, right? But what I've noticed is that if I, on a Saturday afternoon, open my laptop and I'm like, I will now work on this project, I've discovered it's way bigger than a weekend. So like, if I just start randomly hacking at stuff, like, I'm not going to know where I am. I'm not going to know where the end is. I'm not going to feel like I'm making progress, and I'm going to be in the middle of the weeds somewhere, you know, and then I'm going to have to stop after 3 hours. And then, like, did I get anywhere or not? So what I realized is that, like, for myself, if I'm actually going to make progress on this kind of bigger overhaul that I have to do for this subscription API thing, I'm going to have to shape it. Shaping it means I'm going to have to figure out, what are the major subsystems? What are the things that still work in the existing code? What are the things that I don't get to use anymore? Where am I going to define interfaces between what gets to stay and what needs to get swapped out? Of the things that get swapped out, which of those things do I need to integrate as a custom built thing on my back end, versus how much of Stripe's new stuff can I lean on? Stripe has a whole new, like, billing API that does a whole bunch of stuff that my old code used to do. So how am I going to redraw those boundaries? And then what's going to happen is, out of that, I'm going to get these kind of, like, different scopes of work where I kind of know where I am on this little kind of, like, treasure map, this, like, hand-drawn, you know, like, map of, I need to do this over here and that over here and then this over here. So maybe this weekend I'll get this part done, you know? So that's an example of, like, I have limited time and energy. I don't want to just dive into something and then have it turn out to be way more complicated than I thought, and then, like, waste my weekend. So I'm going to do this shaping work to protect my downside, you know? And then I'm going to make kind of a deliberate bet about, I am willing to spend X number of hours on this part of the improvement based on what I have understood by the shaping work that I've done going in. So that's an example of how, like, all this shaping and betting stuff still makes sense on a kind of individual level. But the dynamics of it, when you go up to the second order and you say, like, I'm trying to manage an organization, and we are making investments of, like, other people's time, now you're in a kind of different situation. So my first thought, based on what you described, is that you are, you're in a situation that's, here's another thing. And sorry, I'll try not to go on like for hours with all this because I have a million ideas, but like ShapeUp is designed to be more effective from the top down. Mm-hmm. I think top-down leadership is lacking in this agile scrum world. It's like, hey, let's all just have a meeting and decide what to do together for the next 2 weeks. Instead of leadership saying, like, this is what matters, this is what we want to do. And then opening up more, ShapeUp opens up much more bottom-up inside of the project execution. So the teams have way more freedom to actually execute, but the boundaries are being set more clearly from the top and down. What I'm seeing in what you described is that it seems like leadership, this release lead with input from Matt, is kind of creating channels where, like, if people choose to invest their time in this way, you know, there's a future for it in this period, in this window of time, right? But that's kind of a big if, and that's different than making a, so there is a kind of sense of like you're making trade-offs, you're assuming that there's a limited amount of work that can get done, you're making priorities across that work, but it's kind of different than betting. It's a little bit more like you're creating a kind of a selection criteria, or it's like you're putting a filter into place that says there's a whole bunch of bottom-up activity that's happening, and this is what we are going to select out of that bottom-up activity. These are the kinds of things that we are going to accept if someone chooses to work on them. So this is much more of a selection mechanism and a filtering mechanism than it is like a shaping process.
Yeah, so I'd say that's right. We got a bottom-up approach, which seems like the natural approach maybe for not necessarily the right approach, but the natural approach for an open source community. And then we also have layered on top of that these multi-year big picture initiatives that come from Matt. So one idea that I'm hearing here is, and again, this is a little counterintuitive for something that's supposed to be so open, but I think you're right, is what if we had more top-down leadership, a more top-down approach, something like a WordPress product council that could be made up of, say, Matt, and maybe we have this idea of core contributors that have a permanent status on the project. Maybe some of the core contributors could be involved, and maybe even a rotating list of the release leads or something like this.
So, first, and I need to put a grain of salt in here because this isn't my world. So I'm looking at your world through the lens of my world and trying to say, you know, what can I imagine? And then I'm also drawing a little bit from what I see. I'm not an insider in the Rails world, but I am a sort of very near outsider. Like I'm, right on the outside edges of it, seeing some things happen there. What I think is, like the way to think about this is when you control resources, so people's time, you can be more top down and intentional about like, where do I want to put this time and energy that is sort of at my disposal? I think that what we would probably see, and you can tell me if it's not the case, is that in a situation like a big open source project, that you actually have both situations. You have a wide pool of individual contributors whose time you kind of don't own, right? Yep. And so there's going to be a kind of chaotic bottom-up activity where the only way for you to sort of make that productive is to put selection mechanisms in place, like we just talked about, okay?
Yep.
Then there's going to be, so this is a little bit more like we're putting a kind of a evolutionary hat on our heads and saying like, you know what I mean? This is a kind of organic process and we're just going to use selection pressure to guide it, right?
Yep.
But at the same time, and within that, there is some smaller pool of people who are more in the center of the organization or the project who are kind of in cahoots with each other. You know, like there's like, you talk to each other directly and it's not, and you can kind of make things happen because you are organized, right? And among this group of people, so this is, for example, like as an outsider, I'm just looking at like David and in the Rails community. And then he has, like, of course, like, some of the core Basecampers are also the main contributors, because we extract things from new versions of Basecamp into Rails.
Yeah.
That's a case where David can have an idea of the new way, right? Or maybe it comes from one of the other, I mean, I don't know where they come from. I'm sure they also come from some of the other geniuses that are in our programming teams. And also there's probably some core people in the Rails community that are not at Basecamp where big ideas come from. I don't actually know.
Yep.
I could imagine. But anyway, some new big idea comes up. Like, let's just rewind in history and say, like, REST. There was a point when REST was new, and it was like, we should rethink everything to be restful by default. This was like a point in time where David identified this as a priority. And I'm making up the story. It may have gone differently, but you know, I'm imagining. So this is the best I can do, is kind of BS my way through it. But, like, I think the structural features will come through, which is that, like, somebody says, this is important. This isn't a situation where we just, you know, if somebody works on this, we are going to select it in, but we kind of don't know. This is a case where, like, David might personally say, like, I'm going to spend a weekend hacking on this to figure out what this core outline of this looks like, or have a handful of close collaborators and say, hey, let's make this into a new thing. And this could go into Rails, whatever, N+1, you know? And that's a case where there is the people who are doing the work and the people who are creating the work are the same people, you know?
Yeah.
And then there's a sense of, like, how do we use our time? That's the abstract structural situation where shape up applies.
Hmm.
We have time that we together as a group own somehow. There's this pool of time that us as a little group has. How will we use that? Well, let's not just dive in and start, like, hacking on something that we don't even know what we're doing. Let's shape it. And then after we've shaped it, let's say, like, how much do we believe in this, and how much do we understand it, and how risky is it, and how much upside is there? And then say, do we want to really take this on as the thing that we really, like, put our noses down and hack on? Yes. And then that's making the bet. Right. And I think that you could have both of these happening in parallel, where you have a kind of top-down driven process among a pool of people whose time is kind of shared together of, like, what do we work on?
Yep.
And then you have a kind of selection mechanism to allow contributions coming in from the outside world that you kind of don't really control.
I think you've well described what is fairly the current state. Perhaps it's hard to say, like, how intentionally or how much we're really benefiting from it being conscious.
Hmm.
But I can see that working, where the broader community is surfacing, like, hey, this needs to get addressed. This needs to be done. A selection process facilitates that. But I take Gutenberg as an example. It's a significant, like, rebuilding of the front end editor in WordPress. That wouldn't have just happened over the course of it. It was too big. It had to span, whether it was done, like, a lot of people criticized, and fairly, the first 2 years of the process, because it required this sort of, no, we're going to do this. I think there's a lot of opportunity to do that better.
I think if you're conscious of the dynamics you're in, you know, and whose time you're using in what way, and what expectations are going to be, you can successfully set and fulfill, then you can avoid some kind of unnecessary heat and friction that come out as noise from the process.
Yeah.
You know, because if you kind of aren't very conscious of these things,
well put,
then you can kind of easily be saying, like, hey, everybody, like, why? We're supposed to be working on this, and, like, why not? Why isn't it happening? Or, you know what I mean? Versus if you kind of know who you're lining up and how and what the expectations are, then it can be a higher signal thing. But I don't think there's anything revolutionary here. I think I'm just trying to articulate what naturally happens.
Yeah. A guiding process. So let it bubble up, let it happen naturally, let the community sort of work on what they work on, but try and guide that in an evolutionary sense.
Yeah. And then at the same time, if you have some people who actually agree that either because of employment or because of a social contract with each other, that, like, we work on this thing together, we're like some sort of a core team or, you know, then you can treat your time as something that you make bets on, and then you can do shaping together, and you can be very deliberate about, like, where do we want to go? Like, I think about, like, a band when you play in a band, you know, there can be like chaos of just goofing around together, but there can also be like, hey, are we going to rehearse this song today?
Let's do the song. Yeah.
Let's do the song. Right. That's a kind of top down flip of like, oh, okay, we have limited time and we're going to get in this particular direction at the end of that time.
Yeah, I'd like to see more small teams, more bands in WordPress, because at the moment, the only bands really come from Automattic. Maybe one takeaway or one new idea could be around this idea of forming consistent small teams, you know, with that social contract that you mentioned, that, you know, they don't even have to work for the same company. You know, what if there was just four contributors, you know, with a good variety of skills, that decided, hey, we're going to work together on core for a certain amount of hours each week.
And from my perspective, I think this has been really helpful. One of the opportunities that I see is to take kind of what's already there and just provide some more, like articulate better, like how the process works, because you can never make everyone happy. I think there's a lot now on the other side of like a big project like Gutenberg. I think more people appreciate that. Like some people would demand, let it all be out in the open. It's like, well, that actually is not how the best creative work happens. Like there needs to be a clear process.
Because you can't make trade-offs within a community, but a small team can make trade-offs.
Exactly. And I think there's opportunity here just to better clarify that process. And
that's huge. That's very huge to be able to say, look, because of the type of work that we are in with this particular thing, we have to organize ourselves differently than when we work on this other thing.
Yeah.
And then there's it's not about this philosophical debate about what is true and good. It's a practical question of what is effective in a given circumstance.
Ryan, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure.
If you want to follow Ryan, which I absolutely recommend you do, my personal recommendation is checking out Synthetic A Priori, which is a design product, product design, product strategy, maybe more podcast, which is very in depth and I've gotten a lot out of it. Otherwise, you can find him at RJS on Twitter and feltpresence.com.
Yeah, I would just give a little sequence to all that. Like, if you want something that's practical, ShapeUp is the best starting point. And then if you still are looking for things that are very practical, then Felt Presence would be like the next step, because there's a bunch of articles and talks and stuff that are from there. And then the Twitter and especially Synthetic A Priori are a little bit more like bleeding edge, trying things out, you know what I mean? Like kind of talking within the inner circle of nerds who have the same language and stuff like that. So, you know, like those places can be fun, but they aren't necessarily the most consumable. So it's a question of whether you want to play out on the edges or if you want something that's sort of ready to take home.
Fantastic. Thanks for taking the time with us.
Thanks so much, guys. Really interesting to look at this open source, like this connection, you know, between these two. I hadn't done that before. So thanks for the chance.